Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. We're delighted to have
Tony Blair, T-Man, B-L-A-I-O. You're in our hearts, I know you had to go. It doesn't stop it hurting, so I say, Tony Blair, with your gentle face, your heart of gold and strength of God's. The day you left this place, the country went to the docks. But I know you're only one man in the world that needs fixing. Could I gather all your friends together, we'd all pitch in. And when the world was fixed, we'd gather round the people in their millions, and we'd raise the crown to the new King Tony Blair. God save our gracious Tony Blair. Long live our noble Tony Blair. God save
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello. And just before I came on air, I recorded a 45-minute analysis and breakdown of Blair's extraordinary 5,700-word essay, Simon.
Meaty.
Kind of ballasting, broadsiding Labour, really quite scathing about Labour and the country in general, and about basically why politics is a waste of time unless everybody does what he says. And he also went on the BBC, and it was interviewed by Nick Robinson. And it was an interesting interview because, unlike many other Dark Lord watches I've done, Nick Robinson kind of pushed back on him quite a bit. So, you know, that was interesting because Blair is back. I thought he'd been very quiet for months and months and months, uncharacteristically quiet. But I think that he's been regenerating in a Lazarus pit because he's about 10 years younger than last we saw him. He seems to have like de-aged. And clearly he's got a bee in his bonnet. Extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. He's come back at the turning of the tide. He's making a list, checking it twice. He's going to find out who's naughty and who's nice.
I have to be honest.
He actually de-aged himself, or have they done that on the edit or what?
I don't know, because he was on the BBC with Nick Robinson. He was looking very sharp.
Sleek.
And he's also done one with The Times. And I have to say, Horace, he's sounding very, dare I say, libertarian. Like, he kind of praised Javier Milei, like, in a backhanded way during the article. And, like, literally just wants to, like, completely dismantle the state and have it replaced with public-private partnerships and AI, essentially. That's basically what he wants to do. He wants to just gut the state. And scrap net zero as well. So, you
know. I mean, he's close friends with Larry Ellison, isn't he? For one tech lord, you know. Like,
yes, you know. And he's actually asked. He's asked about that by Nick Robinson, I'll go through in that video tomorrow. And he's literally like, the way he answered that question is extraordinary. He's like, oh, you know, people watching this will just note the millions that you get from Larry Ellison. And he's like, he just says, I'm happy to work with Larry because we agree. Which I thought was an amazing, just like a disarming way of just coming back on that. It was like, yeah, we think the same stuff. So, of course, if he gives me millions of pounds, I'm happy about it.
It's always been his way, isn't it? He's not necessarily someone who hides the truth. He's someone who just presents it from his own angle and just makes it sound like it's fine, you know.
Well, yeah. I thought for a bit of a laugh here, we might actually watch a bit of a Tone in action, because I did the Nick Robinson interview, but there's a separate one that he did with the Times that I haven't seen. Fancy a little Dark Lord watch, and then we'll hit.
Yeah, it's a very seductive article. If people in the chat haven't read it yet, you should go away and have a look. It's very well done. Obviously, it's the usual Blair caveat that his priors and his assumptions are all embedded, but so softly you can't feel it. But you're aware.
He presents his conclusions as the definitive answer, the correct analysis.
Yeah,
and everybody else is just wrong. Automatically, yeah. And wasting time on old-fashioned 20th century ideas, whereas he is always the future. He is always the decision's already been made, really.
It's obvious what's right, yeah. And you're all just being a bit silly by not getting it.
And there's a silky, penetrating way that he writes. I have to say that it made me feel like, you know, those scenes in Lord of the Rings where Frodo's desperate to get away from a situation. He puts the ring on. He goes into that kind of swirly dream world. he can feel the eye burning in the distance, focusing in on him. I thought, I was like struggling. No, Tone, don't go back.
Now, having been through this and basically just been given into it, Simon, many years ago.
Yeah.
When I was watching him with Nick Robinson and reading the article, part of me still just wants King Charles to dissolve Parliament and just appoint Tone. Just like, right, you have got the best ideas. Just go away and fucking do it.
Lord Protector Blair.
Something needs to sort the country out. And if it's between, like, the Labour Party, as it is at the minute, you know, the clown show of reform or whatever, like, who are you going to back to just get the job done? I think he'd do it. I just think he clearly just doesn't give a shit anymore as well. Mm. I mean, he's literally just saying, look, this should just be my dictatorship at this point. Just listen to me.
Yeah.
Let him do it. He's won.
Yeah. And yet he comes back as Tony the White, no longer Tony the Grey.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's a moment in the BBC interview where he's asked about lately, because he said, oh, don't you just agree with Kemi Badenoch and Rishi Sunak on this, right? And he's like, frankly, I just don't care if it's Tory, Labour, Reform, Green, whatever. I just want the job done. I have transcended party politics. I have transcended politics in general.
Yeah.
Just do as I say now.
Yeah. Rising above the fight is such a strong position, you know. And I did notice, I thought there was maybe a couple of AA nods there. You know, he talked about the United States as the shot caller, you know, calling the shot.
Yeah, it was a very realist essay.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, he was personally handed a copy of The Populist Illusion.
Did you read the line? The challenge of democracy is not transparency, honesty, or conspiracy theories about the hidden power of elites. You see what he's done there? He's assumed it's a conspiracy theory. He's making us feel safe and secure that there's no such thing happening.
But isn't maybe he's actually saying it's only the hidden... The theories of hidden elites that I reject.
Well, of course, yeah. He's very carefully worded, isn't he?
That's what I've always said. You don't need the hidden elites. It's there in plain sight. Anyway, let's watch a bit of Tone in action before we Trauma Zone.
Not too high for working people. And some of the things we're spending money on, I think we've got to change. So I particularly identify the very large sum of money we're spending on net zero, which I just don't think is the right priority for the country now.
Yeah, and indeed, you call on the government to halt the net zero acceleration and prioritise cheap energy over clean energy. So just for total clarity, are you advising Keir Starmer to rip up Ed Miliband's green energy targets, for example?
Yes, I am.
As the Labour Party looks like it's heading towards a leadership contest, perhaps they should be taking the advice of their most successful election-winning leader, the former Prime Minister Sir Tony Blair, who warns in a detailed essay this morning that without a clear direction of policy, there's no point, actually, in replacing the leader. Sir Tony Blair joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Callum.
It's good to speak to you. Thanks very much for joining us. It's notable that you spend this entire essay telling the Labour government that their policies are wrong, that their philosophy is outdated, and that they are playing with fire. Why do you think an intervention of this nature at this time is constructive for an unpopular Labour Prime Minister and a beleaguered Labour government?
Look, if things work out and some people want them to work out, we're going to have the seventh Prime Minister in 10 years. I don't think a serious country can behave like that, so there's a big problem. And, you know, I want the Labour Party to do well. I want the Labour Party to be able to win again. And if it's about to change leader, my simple point is you've got to put policy first and the politics second. So first of all, before you change the leader, work out what the right policy direction is for the government. And in the essay, I set out what I think the right policy agenda is, particularly because I believe that all governments today are going to govern in the age of artificial intelligence, which is its own massive revolution.
We'll get on some of the detail in just a second of what you propose, because it is fascinating, genuinely interesting reading. I wonder whose responsibility it is, though, to set out that policy.
It's mine. it's literally my policy.
Yep.
It's my agenda.
We are radical centre now.
Do you remember did you ever watch The Office, right? Do you remember when Swindon Branch comes in? And like Brent is just kind of, you know, that hotshot guy comes in from Swindon Branch. It's like, you know, there is a sense in which this intervention by Blair is like,
he's right, Neil.
this shit show has gone on long enough. Okay, here's the reality. It's like upper management. Mitch and Murray has come from downtown. It's like, what the? You lot are going to have to sort things out now. Here's the bottom line. Here's the reality. Stop sticking about.
Ooh, you're hard.
I got to compliment you on your pause face here as well. That's a great snapshot of Tony Blair.
Yeah. He can do a kind of effective exasperation without it being too overdramatized. He's just like, what can I do? I've told you people, you know, come on. It's like, it's obvious what's going on.
The answer to that would be great if the government set it out.
It should be the government. It shouldn't be down to me. Why am I having to do it? I've ascended. I've gone upstairs here. I'm having to do your homework for you. And frankly, it's not good enough, especially his tone.
Look at that. And he knows how to wear a shirt. That shirt is so crisp. And that it's probably a Brioni suit again.
No tie. Oh, Classic tone.
Yeah, playing the hits.
And look how slick he is. Look, he's back. Do you remember he was a bit haggard for a while, but now he's just like Lazarus pitted up. He's been had his skin replaced with the, you know.
He's gone through his post-coup Gollum look, you know, the evil goblin sort of thing. The head. Do we think there's anything, any meaning in the painting behind him? I wonder. You know, it kind of looks like it's a coffee bar that's run by a gentleman of colour with another gentleman of colour slumped in a desultory fashion in front. It's like something's not working in the coffee bar in Britain today. You're going for your yummy mummy latte, but you're not seeing the, you know, the perfect coffee art in the froth. Oh,
do you remember that doomsday when once I went there and instead of the usual cast of, you know, sappy middle-class women who usually serve it, it was Jamal. Do you remember that? The worst day.
Dark times. Yeah, people in the chat saying it looks like Edward Hopper. That's what I thought as well when I saw it. It's like a strange, slightly grim Edward Hopper. Sort of populist modernism.
You've got to start with an analysis of the way the world's changing. Now, I may be right or wrong about the importance of this AI revolution, but the way I look at it, I think it is the 21st century equivalent of the 19th century industrial revolution. Okay, so it's going to change everything. If I'm wrong about that, then let's debate that. But what is odd is to have a policy agenda that is fashioned more frankly in kind of late 20th century terms of more tax, more spending, or less tax, less spending, rather than trying to think through the consequences of this revolution for business, for your public services, for your welfare system, for government finances.
Blair literally wants to replace basically everything with AI, by the way.
Yeah.
If you, because at the end of that essay, at the end of like the 6,000 word essay, it's got like 10 bullet points. And I would say more than half of them are just like everything, doctor,
yeah,
private sector, public sector, everything's just going to be completely decimated by AI.
This is Dan Hodges, the leftist commentator this morning, you know, one-eyed Dan is calling this client laundering on behalf of Ellison. That he's pushing the AI angle.
It's a little surprise because Hodges is a Blairite, isn't he? He was in Progress, the Blairite body.
He's a creature.
I would say one other thing though, which is that I have noticed that whether we like it or not, AI has kind of massively increased in use, and I've started using it. You know, I have little chats with Grok all the time now. Just Grok, let alone some of the biggest ones. You know, like what's that one that Richard Dawkins went gaga over? Claude, was it? You know, it is getting better. It is starting to be able to do better things. You know, if you some of the image creation, you know, remember it like couldn't do hands and stuff before. Now it's got a lot better. Like now it's got quite a bit better in quite a short amount of time. Have you noticed?
It's good for fast information collation as well. You know, it's not that you have to lean on it so heavily that you stop thinking. But it certainly, if you wanted to go and run off, find you a batch of articles or interviews, it can do that reasonably well. Bring it back to you, then you can read the stuff that you've got.
And does this still work today, I suppose, is the other part of the kind of context for our discussion. You say that governments which succeed start with an idea, a project, a governing purpose, an analysis of what is wrong and a plan to put it right. Is that the same for today's Labour Party as it was for you and New Labour 30 years ago?
Yes. I mean, I don't think that ever alters in politics. Because otherwise, you know, what's the country been doing these last years? It's been kind of shuffling the pack, right? You try this prime minister, that doesn't work. Try another prime minister, that doesn't work. So that's, you end up in a situation where because there's no clarity of direction with a clear project for governing the country, with a clear plan for governing the country, then you're constantly, especially in today's world, which is a really tough environment for politicians to operate in, you just get buffeted to and fro. That's why I use the quote from John Adams, the second president of the United States, about, you know, you've got to have ballast, otherwise you kind of totter in the breeze.
Yes. So then, we come to some of the specifics, I suppose. And some of these, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, could be almost immediate changes that this Labour government could make. So let's start with this. Are working people being taxed too much and therefore paying the price of decisions made by this Labour government?
I think that taxes are too high for working people. And some of the things we're spending money on, I think we've got to change. So I particularly identify the very large sum of money we're spending on net zero, which I just don't think is the right priority for the country now.
Is this not music to your ears, Horace? You know, cut taxes and slash net zero bullshit. I mean, isn't he talking sense?
It's just right of the Labour Party type stuff. I mean, yeah, it's better than Rachel Reeves, yeah.
Yeah, and indeed, you call on the government to halt the net zero acceleration and prioritise cheap energy over clean energy. So just for total clarity, are you advising Keir Starmer to rip up Ed Miliband's green energy targets, for example?
Yes,
I am. Just love it. Fucking fire him yesterday.
What's the thing you talked about, you know, reading body language, and there's the thing of which way people move their eyes, if they're moving to the right or the left. Doesn't one signify fibbing, or one is about looking into the past?
I can never quite remember.
Anyway, just curious. Just curious as to what he was.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he means yes, no, what, or what. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but this is a sideways is typically auditory.
Right.
Auditory. So maybe, I don't know if you can see the guy, but he's accessing speech here.
Yeah.
Rather than a visual memory, is what they say.
Yeah.
Because, and I'll tell you exactly why. And it's not that I'm against renewable energy, clean energy, and it's not that I'm a climate denier, but it's just, it's coming to terms with this reality. The three biggest emitters in the world today are China, America, and India. Together, they account for just over 50% of global emissions, right? All of them are pursuing cheap energy and electrification. Doesn't mean to say they're not doing renewable energy. China builds more renewable energy than the rest of the world put together. It just means that the lens through which they judge policy is cheap energy and the need for electrification, particularly in the age of AI. Britain's emissions are under 1% of global emissions. So we can't solve climate change. And to impose costs on our own business and consumers in order to accelerate to net zero when the rest of the world is not doing so.
See, this is such common sense. Why does Ed Miliband not give up? Because this point is just, I mean, it just completely destroys anything Ed Miliband wants to say or do. Like, how does he possibly come back on this?
He's right about this, but I mean, Blair and Brown, especially Blair, all through his time was constantly going on about, you know, his government and everything was constantly going on about carbon and the Kyoto protocols and fucking, what was it, the, you know, the international thingy body on climate change. And like, that was all flourishing under him. Like, so can't he just for a moment say, you know, I was wrong to push that as well. Because it was the same, like, the argument he made was true, like 1% of, like, Britain's tiny on the scale. You know,
it's not as saying he's wrong. My good esteemed colleague Hector Drummond in the chat is saying there that Ben Pyle, our friend who came on for All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, has said, I mean, what he wants to do is retain the climate change agenda. So the assumptions, the priors remain the same. You know, that's an article of faith, but he's trying to adapt it now in this way that, this is the problem with this interview, as we were saying before the stream, what he's saying, it makes perfect sense. I mean, this was kind of the approach I remember as a child in the 70s, where I was talking to somebody the other night who's in a kind of Dominic Cummings circle and saying, look, we had Anglo-futurism in kids' books in the 70s. You had these, you know, the Osborne Book of the Future. And, you know, the big thing we all thought was going to happen back then was you were going to have levitating trains. You would have maglev trains, yeah? And there were going to be these visions of electric cars and all. It wasn't a major thing. It was just like you'd have a sort of sleek kind of lifestyle that looked much cleaner than the dirty terrace that you might be living on, you know, somewhere in Wigan. And so there was a sense of, well, the scientists are going on and they're doing this stuff. They're developing all this interesting technology, but they're doing that on the side. And you may sort of see reports about it on, you know, the program we had back then was Tomorrow's World. And they'll go to somewhere in Cambridgeshire and say, scientists have developed this thing. And they show you it. And you know, I think that's fabulous, but that'll come online in a few years and we'll be living in the flying car world. And of course, you know, it didn't quite happen. But there was a sense in which they're going to be doing on all that stuff, working on that interesting technology, but they're not going to bankrupt the fucking country in order to get there.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of perfectly reasonable to say, yeah, the Chinese are doing it, but they're doing lots of other stuff. They're still powering their, you know, their country with conventional, you know, coal-fired power stations. Why can't we? They're still using oil. And yeah, they can develop that stuff on the side, but they're not doing it by taxing the bejesus out of us and making it ruinously impossible to stay. I mean, I don't know if you saw the chap who was on the Makerfield by-election the other day, who did the little 13-minute speech to camera, you know, who perfectly distilled and captured that, you know, why can't we just have a sensible approach?
What was his name? Is Frank something? Frank Wrights.
Frank Wright.
I was following him. Frank Wright, his name.
Yeah.
I think he calls himself Frank Wrights as well, doesn't he?
Frank Wright-er. So Frank Wright, as in the architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, but with E-er on the end. Frank Wright, at Frank Wright on Twitter. Brilliant. I mean, he was already following me, and I think a few people found, oh, gosh, he's already been around.
I was already, I think I've talked to him a couple of times on Twitter. I was following him on Substack because he's got some interesting articles already. It's worth checking out.
People will say I should have him on.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't understand the logic behind it, or shutting down our own North Sea oil and gas industry in circumstances where, again, I don't know of another country in the world that's doing that if they've still got a requirement to import energy from oil and gas.
I mean, you've been Prime Minister. You know the gravity of what you've just said. Ripping up the Energy Secretary's plans on this would suggest that his position is untenable. You can't rip up his whole direction and policy agenda and expect Ed Miliband to remain in post after that.
Well, it's really a question of explaining to the country and to Ed. Look, right now...
The look on his face when he answered that question, instead of saying what he said, he just wanted to say, well, just get rid of him then. That's what he was saying with his eyes.
We need to get growth levels up. We need to recognize with this AI revolution that we're going to need cheap energy and energy that allows us to power that AI revolution. And therefore, whatever is the benefit, it's not a question of ripping up the idea of clean energy. It's a question of abandoning what is an unnecessary accelerated target to fulfill that, which both imposes a cost burden and in respect of our own North Sea oil and gas industry means that we're leaving stuff in the ground we could take out and use. And what's more, we're losing the revenue from that.
The way I look at it, Simon, if Labour lose and reform come in, Farage will rip up the climate change bullshit anyway. That's one thing you can count on Farage doing. If Labour do stay in, the Dark Lord's not going to stop until he gets his way. Like, I just cannot see a situation where Ed Miliband's just going to march on indefinitely. That's what's happened so far. But it seems like one way or the other, what he's saying is going to come to pass. That's the sense I get. Because it's untenable. It's just stupid. What he's saying is right. It's just a stupid thing to do. So
and if there is a process behind the scenes, like in the way that, you know, when you have to deal with terrorists, you know, in a conflict situation, even if people say they don't negotiate, they will have to sort of negotiate a way so that the other side doesn't lose face, so that Ed can be, you know, put out of place with his policy, but not lose face politically. If Tony was sensible, I think that something like that would be happening.
So the other aspect of this that's really important is that if our fiscal position is tough, and it is tough, that's why we've had to raise taxes, is it sensible to be spending money on this?
You also note that Britain could soon be spending more on incapacity and disability benefits than on defence. And indeed, you call the pensions triple lock unaffordable in the long term. And you encourage reform on welfare entitlements, basically. But I mean, you know better than I do that doing something like that is deeply painful politically. Can any government survive implementing that level of reform?
Well, that is a very good question. I mean... But you see, when the Conservative Party at an earlier time, I don't know whether this is still their position, offered to cooperate with Labour on welfare, I would have said yes to that. I mean, anybody who looks at this triple lock long term, I'm not suggesting you change it overnight, you can't do that, but long term, it's unaffordable. I mean, it's very clear, you look at the figures. And on incapacity benefit, disability benefit, we've got people of working age, right? Before COVID, you had 2.8 million people claiming those benefits, which was already much too high. By the end of this decade, if we don't stop this explosion in claims of working age people for incapacity disability benefit, we're going to have almost 5 million people. And the state's got to carry that cost.
This is why Blair was like, there's no such thing as a mental health crisis. We have to stop claiming that anxiety is a thing. Mm-hmm. Get back to fucking work. I need you to work for the system to work, damn you. That's basically what he's saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The system, see, this is the system's antibody. It's like Blair's like, look, the whole system's not going to work unless you do these things. You can't have all the unicorn fairy cakes if the system's not working. So.
Go on, horse. You're gone.
I was just going to say, he still only half gets the problem because he says, like, the state is going to have to carry the cost. No, the state is the cost. The state is part of the cost or the reason that it's not, the state doesn't pay anything. The people who work for the state are also obviously paid by the state, as in, like, the whole cost falls on taxpayers. Or in reality, probably just will never be paid. There will probably just be a sudden, abrupt end to the state pension. And and benefits and all sorts. The Gavin Bobie scenario. Anyway, go on, Simon.
I was just merely going to say, I mean, one of the things he's talking about in this essay, which is interesting, is that, again, it's a little echo of David Graeber, whose work we referenced with Can't Get You Out of My Head, where he's attacking the idea, you know, basically Graeber's idea of the bullshit jobs. He says in one part of his essay, it is the ability to get big things done, to have leaders who are problem managers, but not problem managers, but problem solvers. So he's referencing sort of David Graeber talks about people who are duct tapers, you know, who kind of they sort of bodge things together that don't really work in order to keep them going. And I think Blair is kind of that mind to sort of get rid of that tier of just sort of useless kind of bureaucracy. And I think that's the direction he wants to go in and sort of get back to that level of efficiency.
And if you look at where it's coming from, a large proportion of it is from mental health. And, you know, you compare us now with other countries, it's not the same. So you've got to, if you're looking...
So people are just making up stuff to get money. That's basically, he's basically saying that there's a mental health grift going on.
Yeah.
Which is probably true. It's probably true. I see, wow. I saw it myself up close. Half of those conditions people claim they've got are probably made up.
I will say I have a little bit of insight on this. I was speaking recently to somebody who was giving me direct information about, you know, people, when you calculate the benefits for the, some of these things, there's people on sort of roughly mid-20K total income. I'm speaking from someone who had direct knowledge of that.
Mm-hmm. Like all this stuff, like disability incapacity benefit, basically relies upon a GP signing you off, right?
Yeah.
Like, people can get a GP to sign you off. People can find, you know, especially if the GP is their cousin or their sister or, you know, like from the same tribe and so on. It can be done. Like, it's like whatever, like all fucking, all these welfare reforms, like Ian Duncan Smith was a big one and like Andrew Nas, you know, all through the Tory time, they were reforming the welfare state and all this stuff. But there's still these cracks. There's always like just whoever wants to get money out of it will just find the cracks like a mafia guy, you know? They just,
yeah. There's people who are low in conscientiousness, you know, and society has encouraged that low conscientiousness. I think there is an argument to be made, you know, if I'm coming from with my Mark Fisher hat on, where talking about the way capitalism changed in the last 30 years, it became the major producer of anxiety in the way that, you know, people constantly had to go through this routine of continuous professional development and continuous appraisal and auditing their own performance, producing a state of untenable anxiety. So a lot of people did opt out of the economy. You know, it's moving to that place of, you know, 40 years ago you did your job. If you didn't do your job, you were sacked and that was it. Whereas now it's like you're in continuing therapy all the time, especially in bureaucratic jobs or private sector jobs. You're continuously being educated and sort of monitored. And that's kind of mentally unsustainable for a lot of people. And I think there is an argument to be made there that the way the system has manifested itself in this kind of increasing bureaucratization of work, it's meant that lots of people are saying, yeah, actually, I have had enough of working like that. I just want to do a job and be left alone to do it. And you're not left alone.
I worked at one of the, I wouldn't say it was a bullshit job, but I worked at one of these, you know, FTSE 100 companies. And like most of the time, it wasn't too bad, like that sort of stuff. But when you went for an interview or also maybe your annual review or stuff, you know, performance reviews and stuff, but routine ones, not because you were doing badly. But yeah, when I went for interviews within the company and stuff, they'd be like, to tell you beforehand, we're going to ask you this and this, and then we're going to ask you questions about how you demonstrate these two qualities. And there was a list of like 7 or 8 or 9 qualities of the company. And they're just bullshit, obviously, right? And they just, like, the first letter of each spells fucking rainbow or caring or something, you know? And it was just like, how have you shown that you believe in this and this, like, through your actions at work? It's like, I can't show that because it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And it was maddening, like, because mostly the job was all right. But to advance, you had to pretend to be something you're not. It was ludicrous.
And there's, exactly. You have to sort of pretend to be happy to come to work, you know, and do this crappy job. Or you have to pretend to be sort of completely engaged in this kind of deranged machismo of work where you know, somebody commented yesterday on seeing an advert, you know, where it says, you know, you see those adverts for jobs which say, do you want to work in a fast-paced, high-pressure environment? And the person in the tweet said, no, I just want to work in a job.
Are you joking? Know. Yeah.
At the situation of the country in a rational way, you've got to come to terms with some of these problems, and you can't just hope that they solve themselves, or that you can carry on with this big cost on welfare at the same time as you're trying to prioritize investment in education, in infrastructure, and of course in defense.
Yeah. Elsewhere, Sir Tony, you look at Britain's place in the world, and you state that staying sort of alongside the USA means doing so even when it is difficult or unpopular. And we have seen living examples of the difficulty, I suppose, in trying to determine what the correct course of action is with the conflict in Iran just in the last couple of months. Is there any red line for you, working with a Trump administration? You know, in a hypothetical, if a Trump administration completely abandoned Ukraine, for example, or was deemed to have violated international law, should Britain just sort of nod along compliantly just to kind of keep a seat at the top table?
No, of course not. It definitely shouldn't do that. And by the way, just to make it very clear, I'm not advocating that Britain, that was not part of the planning or the discussion for the Iran conflict, could have been part of the Israeli-American action. But I am saying that when your ally asks for help with logistics and with support, in this case, for the refueling of their planes, you've got to think long and hard before you refuse that, because here's what I think people have got to understand about our relationship with America. And it's, again, it's where you have to explain this to people so that they understand the magnitude of the decisions you take in regard to this. I don't believe that President Putin, if the Ukraine war ends, is going to come back and try and invade Europe. I don't believe that personally. But I understand I may be wrong about it. And there are many smart people in Europe that I know who think, yes, he will do that. And I've got to take account of the fact that on every day in April, Putin and Russia lost more forces than the UK did in the whole of its engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan.
See, I wonder if that's true, because when I mentioned Russian losses, I was completely cussed out on recent video, so it's interesting.
You're talking about a different mentality.
I didn't know that he was a dissenter from NATO. He doesn't believe Putin's trying to conquer Europe. That's interesting.
It is interesting, isn't it?
That's kind of what I think. That's just me.
What, you think Putin is trying to conquer Europe?
No, I don't think he is. That's the thing. Grotesquely overhyped the danger of Putin.
If he were to invade the whole, like if he were to try and conquer, or if he now does try to claim, I don't think there's any, but if he were to go beyond just the Donbass in the current war, I would be against him. But I don't believe it's even that. We'll see how that war concludes. But like, if he was to menace Poland, I'm on Poland's side. Like, I hate NATO, but I'm still on Poland's side there. But like, I think it's completely made up. There's just none of that. It's about the Donbass, this particular war. It's just about the Donbass, like. And how they relate to, and how Russia relates to Ukraine, and just the NAFO NATO twats have just made it all about.
It is surprising that Blair has such a sensible line on it. Very surprising.
I am surprised.
He's probably lost over 300,000 dead in this conflict. So that's why I don't think the government is foolish in saying, "We've got to be prepared for the possibility of conflict in the future." But let's be very clear. Without America, we don't win that conflict. Or we can't be sure of winning that conflict. So America is not an important ally. It's an indispensable part of our security. So when they come asking for our help, you've got to think long and hard before you refuse it. Because if they are an indispensable part of our security...
I can see the angle he's working now, Simon. Now it makes sense.
We should stand with them if we can. And that doesn't mean to say joining every action they do. I mean, for example, I don't think this was ever going to happen. If they seriously considered taking Greenland or something, of course you wouldn't have said yes to that. But this is action in respect of Iran, and we were being asked for support, not to be part of the military action.
Yeah. You talk about radical centrism. You've talked about that before, and you drive home that point in these 5,000 or so words in this essay as well. You also talk about the importance, as you have done in this conversation, in a fascinating way, about policy over personality. But I can't escape our listeners' attention, Sir Tony, that your personality was a huge part of your electoral success. is it not too easy to dismiss the importance of personalities in politics? And does that not account for the popularity of the likes of Reform UK and the Green Party, that the characters at the heart of those movements are, in some way, attractive to a noticeable chunk of the electorate?
Yeah, look, of course you're right to a degree. I mean, I'm not saying personality doesn't matter in politics.
Pause.
But if you take my own case...
Can I just say, just comment in the chat, somebody picked up on the word there, said radical, not sensible. I will point out that in the essay, Blair has said, when he's talking about what he's proposing, he says, an agenda of this nature, radical but sensible. So he's hitting another AA word there. He believes radical and sensible.
No matter how good or not I was at communicating, presenting, if we hadn't been New Labour, we would never have won 3 full terms of government. I mean, remember the Labour Party's 120-year history, right? It is only once.
Notice he does not deny his amazing Football Manager stats. He doesn't say, like, no, you know, he acknowledges objectively that he has good Football Manager stats, but he's still up to the point.
Ever won a 2 full terms of government.
I'm just waiting for him to say sensible and centred, Simon.
Yeah, it's coming.
Only once in 120 years. And I don't think that was to do with my personality. It was to do with the political position of Labour. So I'm not saying personality is irrelevant.
Yeah.
But it's not the only thing. And I think with the Greens and Reform, by the way, I think it's slightly different. I think people, look, I don't agree with Nigel Farage's politics, but people think he is sort of stood by what he thinks over a long period of time. And that is to his advantage. I think it's, all I'm saying in this essay is that ultimately you have to have a clear project that's coherent and worked out. If you do, I don't think it really matters ultimately whether you've got a touchy-feely politician or not. I think it's more important to have the policy worked out properly. Yeah. Put it like that.
Yeah. And just one thing I want to put to you that is perhaps not considered in this essay, or perhaps it's in there in a kind of more subtle way, is this consideration that there are 3 first ministers in the 3 nations of the UK who are kind of separatist. They have a separatist agenda, if I can put it like that, and that's not supposed to be pejorative. But is there a consideration in your own thinking as to how a Labour government, a Labour prime minister should address the United Kingdom?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And look, the problem, I mean, I introduced devolution of government, did the Good Friday Agreement for Northern Ireland. I support it, by the way, and think it was necessary. Otherwise, I do think we'd have broken up the United Kingdom. But I think Brexit put another strain on the UK. And I do think inevitably with devolution, there was a sort of, it's in some ways,
a
growing apart of the different parts of the UK. I do think it's really important to go back, and for the Labour Party in these areas, strongly to make the case for why the UK is a good idea. And, you know, it needs to do that without trying to follow some of the nationalist rhetoric. So I always say to the Labour Party in Scotland, don't try and out-nationalist the nationalists. Explain why they're wrong, why they're profoundly wrong. And I think you're right that it does mean that you're going to have to take a lot more time to try and bring the UK together, to make them realise that just as it was foolish for Britain, in my view, to leave Europe, to leave the alliance of its own continent, it's foolish for these countries to break up the UK.
Sir Tony Blair, thank you very much.
So there it is. There it is, Dark Lord. More of that tomorrow. I actually think the Nick Robinson interview was better, because I think maybe Nick Robinson has the seniority to push back on Blair a bit more than that young kid that is working for the Times.
Agree.
Clearly, Blair could overawe that chump. He was a jobber at that Times interviewer. Yeah. Whereas Robinson could kind of, you know, press him a little bit more without being overawed by Tony.
Did Nick Robinson have a swipe at Rupert Lowe in the last couple of days as well? Is that right?
I saw Charlie Downs tweeted a clip of Robinson did a piece with another commentator talking about how it was the party of angry young men. So yeah, there was a gentleman's put down, as you might say.
That's the BBC's opinion, is it, of Restore? Yeah,
nice. Well, I mean, that's the thing. They can smuggle in their opinions under the guise of, well, we're just trying to characterise it in the sort of political spectrum as is. I will say the interesting last point there that Blair made, and this is something that struck me throughout reading his piece as well. Again, he is echoing Curtisian themes. I know I'm always saying this, but Curtis talks about that thing of the left has to capture something with the power of nationalism, but not nationalism. You know, some idea of collectivity that works, but doesn't lead to the kind of, you know, the chaos and violence of the 20th century, essentially.
And Blair being put on trial for treason as well.
Yeah, you and your friends with the hoods on.
I just said, if I was back there, they would be my answer.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, that was fun. Let us now switch into reviewing Adam Curtis. Hold on. Look at this. Does that work? There he is. Look.
Smooth segue. The fat controller is in command.
There he is. There's one of us. Yeah.
Before we move on to Curto, we sometimes do shout, you know, like sometimes do, like, where can we find you? Like,
yeah, let's do that now.
Instead of me, I just want to give a shout out and a nod towards all the people going up and stomping the street for restoring Makerfield. Just well done to you. You are doing like so much more than I thought Restore could muster. You know, there's obviously like real enthusiasm and people are actually making the effort and traveling and going and doing the work. I just think that's really good. So. Good on you.
Yeah, Wolf. Yeah, seconded.
Yeah, no, I also, I mean, I don't know if anybody caught office hours yesterday, but the Brendan O'Neill article, which was slamming those same people that Horace just talked about as nerds and kind of oddballs. You know, like, what a disgrace.
Because they are deranged.
They are literally just normal people if you see them in the pictures. So obviously. Yeah. Mums and dads and kids and, you know, it's just, they're just obviously normal people to be smeared. And yeah. Like he was trying to make out that they were like crusade LARPing internet weirdos. And such a dishonest characterization.
He did that faux chud bluster down the pub, you know, give them what for kind of thing, you know. It's like, bloody idiots think they are, you know. Come on, Ben, Brendan. Brendan off the site.
Awful man. Like, what is he about? Let's not go. I mean, it's a whole other topic, but Spike.
But it read badly. It read badly for him.
It did.
I wonder if more people watched my stream yesterday than read his article. I would be willing to bet that more people watched my stream on it than read his article. But anyway, but before we get going here, there are literally days left to get the promo code COOL discount. I did do a webinar yesterday and I didn't know that the webinar is capped at 65. Such was the demand for this that I may well just put it out on the channel. I don't know if anybody was able to catch that webinar but I mean, yeah, it was pretty hard to get into. And I think people were, as one person went out, another person went in. So I might just stick it out on the channel so people get to. I basically spent an hour trying to fix this absolutely awful Substack article about AI slop, but it was written in the worst possible way. And I go through some principles of good writing and so on, just to try to encourage people to sign up to Foundations of Writing.
I think the reason it was a good, difficult one actually was actually, do you know, I think there's that tagline on the advert, isn't there, about. The foundations of writing or whatever, that you say, you know, in order to think clearly, you need, you know, or to write clearly, you need to think clearly. Or
yes.
But the thing is, she just couldn't think clearly. So
yeah, she just has no idea what she's trying to say at all.
Yeah.
All right, let's play the promo and we'll hit Kyoto. Everybody wants to be cool. Like this guy. This guy is cool. Do you know who else is cool? People who do courses at the academic agency. And you too can be cool by getting a course today with promo code COOL, which gets you 25% off all courses. Today. Promo code COOL. All right, guys. So let us now pick up. We were about 40 minutes in, and there is a miserable Russian woman sleeping.
Yes.
Ну, у тебя очень странная прическа. Где тебя так красиво подстригли?
Знакомилась с панками московскими, они подстригли.
The guy in the chat who thinks it's a good idea to call my academic agency a world-class site, scamademic scam agency, shape NWO. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think I take kindly to jokes? Do you think I like having my business attacked in my own chat? Obviously a band.
А что это за течение-то, панки?
Ну, это люди, которые любят свободу, там терпят насилие. Там.
А ты не свободна, да?
Свободна.
Последний раз когда в школе-то была?
Год назад.
Год назад. А
did we say this is like about 88 sort of time?
89.
В мае месяце. Значит, полгода не была дома, полгода не видела родителей. Лен, плохо. Ну, мне кажется, у тебя что-то случилось.
Да, у тебя ничего не
случилось.
Лучше меня ничего не спрашивают.
Ну, ясно. Потом тогда расскажешь.
Pause. This is a clip from the Comrades documentary that I talked about from the mid and later 80s in earlier episodes. This is one that's not available online. It's called Class of 89. It seems to be like a girls' reformatory school. These are all somewhat troubled young women. I mean, it's clearly with that girl there, something's happened to her, something not very nice. I don't know what. But this goes kind of to the heart of part of why Curtis is calling the series Trauma Zone. He talks about it in various interviews. He says he was trying to really sort of reclaim the word trauma. He was very aware of social media, things like TikTok. And he says TikTok at that time, about three, four years ago, was obsessed with trauma. But it was all about the trauma of the individual, he said. And he said the title came about because he talked to a number of Russians and they all said the period was like a trauma for millions of people. And he wanted to sort of reclaim the word and say, you know, this is real trauma. So he's kind of showing it you from sort of several different dimensions of what we're talking about, various kinds of broken people that we see, especially in this last bit of this last episode. He said all the traditional documentaries about Russia go and interview Yeltsin, and then they have a finger-wagging narration. And he says this is what the Russians call West-splaining.
So Russia itself was the trauma zone sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's also analogous to us as well, because what he's, as I said in the first episode, he is talking about the collapse of empires over a protracted period. And he mentions a lot in the interviews that, you know, ours took about 80 years to collapse and the Russian Empire is still collapsing. And it comes out in all these kinds of ways that he's showing that we feel we're trying to live quite a normal life, but actually we're sort of slipping into all these kind of underground ways of being, these kind of maladaptions sometimes, or just, you know, acts of cultural resistance. I'll talk about that at the end of the episode, but it kind of ties into things that Toynbee is saying about, you know, cultural retreat as well.
Kim Philby.
Yes.
Real piece of shit.
It's kind of interesting that he's someone who betrayed his country to get to the Soviet dream, and then when he got there, he hated it.
Yeah. Like Guy Burgess moved over there at the same time and just drank himself to death.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to watch a good TV drama, I thought it was good anyway. Guy Pearce played Kim Philby in A Spy Among Friends. I thought it was a good drama. Mm-hmm.
Curtis talks about this on the blog. He says it's an amazing record of a weird communist state funeral held for an upper-class Englishman in a Moscow graveyard in 1987. Standing all around are the faces of the Russian side of the spy world, and it is great to look at their faces peeking out for a moment from their traditional secrecy.
They gave him, when he defected, they gave him quite a high rank, like, major or something, quite high.
Yeah,
probably. And, but they didn't trust him, apparently. They just, because he's a traitor, obviously. And they continued to apparently open his mail and everything until he died.
Yeah. It seems like he was quite erratic and probably had a bit of a drink problem himself. Was quite angry about the state in which people lived.
He blamed Guy Burgess for him, Philby, having to move there. And he never wanted to be there and didn't really like it. And I don't think he liked the people he met. And
no.
Just, yeah, generally no. Unhappy. Although he did meet a Russian wife, is that right?
That's Rafinha.
I imagine this guy is a hero of John McDonnell.
Yeah.
John McDonnell's Philby. Yeah, he's got Philby posters on his bedroom wall and stuff like that.
Yeah. This is going back to the BBC 1977 clips from the Togliatti plant, but actually, just to say that Curtis is actually talking about really a period much later from the early 90s where Togliatti was pretty much riven by gang violence. This is the Avtovaz plant, and how he'll tell, you know, how Boris Berezovsky got in and managed to sort of siphon off loads of the cars and turn them into money. And this was... You know, it's difficult without sort of perhaps knowing what he's going on about here, but he's analogizing the way that the Soviet Union was playing with an economic experiment of free marketism. And he said what was happening at the time when he was putting this documentary together was that, you know, obviously Liz Truss came in and tried to do a similar sort of thing, and the markets kind of, you know, felt it was going to collapse the economy. But the problem then was that it went back to the conventional sense of British politics, you know, the adults are back in the room, we want to stabilize things. And he said the irony was all the people who had been calling for change were now again saying how wonderful it was, you know, like Andrew Marr, you know, he talked about how things have gone back to normal again. You know, again, it was that sense in which the elites sort of kind of don't really know what they want. They play with these ideas of having a grand economic regime change. And then when it looks too destabilizing, they kind of pull back into this stability where nothing changes.
By the way, were these called Togliatti cars?
No, these were Lada. This was the Lada plant. Okay. And this was, I mean, this sort of got really, really very violent. There were lots of Afghan war veterans in the town in Togliatti. I mean, Togliatti plant is the biggest kind of industrial production site in the world. It's absolutely massive. I'll put a picture up of it. And the kind of, one of the things that Curtis says is there were actually people killing each other on the factory floor. I couldn't really find evidence for that, but there were a lot of killings, gang killings related and around. And you could sort of get the sense that, well, if it may not have been on one factory floor, it could have been in the Togliatti complex, because they did literally kill a number of people, like about 65 employees, including managers, were killed. But it's very hard to find stuff in English language. I think there's more stuff in Russian language on what was going on at Togliatti. But a lot of it was these Afghan war vets fighting with things like Chechen, you know, criminals who were coming in to take advantage and just, you know, take the stuff out of the factory, convert it into hard cash, you know, sell stuff off, you know, because they could get away with the state producing it at a sort of nominally negligible cost and then taking the larders away and flogging them for a big markup. But it did get very bad. I mean, between about 1998 and 2004, there was about 550 people killed, and it got even worse as well. You know, sort of running gun battles, three people a day were sort of getting knocked off by the gangs.
That's not just end of the Soviet era. You're talking about well into Putin's time.
It does get that way, yeah. But yeah, it was pretty much from around 1988, 89, and sort of through the 90s and just nudging into the early 2000s, and then they launched something called Operation Cyclone to try and get order. They literally sent in the military to sort of you know get control of things again. And meanwhile, Berezovsky was in this operation of trying to sort of reconfigure the business as a consultant almost, and in so doing, you know, again drain the place of its resource. I mean, that was what essentially was happening. Togliatti was a very inefficient place. You know, I mean, it would take about 450 man hours to make a car, right? And that was compared to about 15 hours if you're in Japan making a Toyota. So it could kind of just sort of rumble on, and a lot of people were employed in the town, but it was grossly inefficient. So people just siphoned off the resources in order to make money elsewhere.
Just to add that implies 30 times as many man hours and probably a less good car than most Japanese cars.
It was better than there were lots of Russian cars that were really rubbish. But the Lada was kind of relative. I mean, Adam Curtis used to drive a Lada, apparently.
Right.
So he's slightly attached. But there was, there was a scarcity, and so they could get a premium on the black market for, you know, siphoning off parts and vehicles. And I mean, there was hundreds of thousands of, you know, pounds in today's money that just sort of disappeared. And, you know, journalists who were in the town who tried writing about it would just be killed, you know, because they kind of knew too much about
it. Awful situation. Like, if gangsters are taking over stuff, I mean, you're in a really dire state.
Yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah.
The reason I made that comparison to the cost of, added to the comparison about the cost of Japanese cars, just the extent there is a world market. I mean, car buying is a somewhat, you know, global market since, I don't know, the last sort of 50, 70 years or something. You know, some Ladas and Skodas were bought in Britain during the Cold War, I think a few, you know. But like, Japanese cars have for a long time been, you know, decent. I don't know if anyone would say they're brilliant, apart from the Lexuses, but, you know. But, you know, like Mitsubishis and Nissans and stuff, they're probably quite good, you know, fairly good for the fairly good value and stuff. And like, the Lada, I imagine, could only be sold to people who specifically wanted a Lada, right? Because like, the cost of value, the value would just be awful, judging by what you said.
Yeah, they were sort of a good budget car, but over time, the problem was that, you know, the tools wore out, you know, the dies and stamps kind of wore out. So eventually the quality sort of kept getting slightly worse. But, you know, as I say, the thing with Berezovsky is he could shift these cars. I mean, it was roughly 2,000 cars a day they'd be putting out. The figures vary. Sometimes they say up to 700,000 cars a year, but Berezovsky might, you know, take 10,000, you know, in a week and send them off somewhere. And because it was a state-controlled factory and prices were subsidized, he could basically buy them at very low cost. And because the hyperinflation was increasing, the rubles he paid them with were getting increasingly devalued. So he could buy more for a lot less. And Curtis draws analogies with this in interviews about how, you know, people learn in these collapsing systems to be able to come in, and it's happened in our country as well, and siphon off an awful lot of money by tricks that are not necessarily illegal. They're just little, you know, back doors that enable you to, you know, gain a foothold with, you know, scarce resources.
I just wanted to say that I remember all through when I was a kid and into being a teenager, Lada and Skoda were the butt of every joke. They were just the absolute joke car. And if somebody had one, it'd just make fun, or people would make fun. So
like a Robin Reliant also.
They were in the same category as a Robin Reliant.
But yeah, younger people wouldn't know that. But like, yeah, when we were kids, Lada was a byword for a shit car. Skodas come from Czechoslovakia, don't they? Skodas win prizes and stuff. They're notoriously good cars now, according to some awards.
Well, I seem to remember there was some period where both of those cars had a major kind of image change. I want to say in the 2000s, when all those Eastern Bloc countries joined the EU, there was a kind of like, oh, actually Skoda and Lada are quite good cars now. And they had a kind of PR image change at some point. And it was suddenly socially acceptable to have one.
Yeah. I mean, again, a thing that Curtis is doing here is comparing it with, he talks on his blog about you know, this was called gangster capitalism and people thought it couldn't happen here. He said, but 10 years later, something rather similar did happen in the Midlands. Starting in 2000, one of the few remaining bits of British Leyland, the Longbridge plant, was brought to its knees in very much the same way by its own senior managers. They siphoned off money that was supposed to help rescue the plant and instead used it to enrich themselves. You know, in 1999, BMW had given up on what was now called the Rover Group. A Rover manager called John Towers dramatically announced he had created the Phoenix Consortium with a Rover car dealer called John Edwards and two other directors. Their aim was to rescue the company. And then the government report came out and told what actually happened. They'd restructured the business and they did it in a way that ensured, you know, many economic benefits flowed not to MG Rover and the thousands of workers, but to the directors themselves. So, you know, nothing changes.
Remember that being in the news at the time, and unfortunately, like, you get, you know, sort of one side of the debate will take the shit position, so you get a shit debate, and it was that, like, we've got to save this because this is a classic British brand. The same thing happened when Cadbury's was bought out by Kraft from America. It was like, yeah, so it's a British tradition. It's like, yeah, but I don't like Cadbury's chocolate, though. I mean, like, you know, and at the same time, like, the real reason was, like, what you just said, you know, like the real reason to actually care is that this is corruption or this is like malpractice.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. He talks about the people in Phoenix Consortium in the UK when they were doing this. He said, literally one of the guys went out and bought a piece of software called Evidence Eliminator. And then lots of files that would have been useful in the situation sort of disappeared from the company.
Like people got to realize Britain is not above corruption whatsoever. There's plenty of it.
It's you surprised me.
Yeah. Looks marvelously Soviet.
Well, at least they're using the rail for freight, unlike us.
Does everyone remember when Berezovsky died?
Yeah, wasn't he found dead at his home in, like, south of England somewhere?
Yeah, like Surrey or Sussex.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Yeah. He was unexpectedly died, right? I don't think there's ever a shown to be murdered, but. He was an enemy of Putin, wasn't he? That's why he was in Britain.
Yeah, yeah. I think what Curtis is doing this footage, the fashion show, it's kind of a sort of, you know, counterpoint to that stuff about capitalism. It's a sort of posed formality and a society which you kind of... I'll pause. I was just going to say I shouldn't have tried talking over that. I think the fashion show it's kind of where you're sort of simulating the propriety of how people should look and behave, but it's this idea that Russia comes in and takes on this experiment with extreme capitalism, and there isn't any of, you know, like you said, Horace, we have this kind of supposed moral scaffolding around capitalism. We have this sort of Western bourgeois morality about how it should be conducted, and you know, our progressive governments fight what they think is a kind of action to, you know, instantiate controls and you know, safety guardrails on that capitalism. In Russia, it becomes this kind of simulation. You know, it's capitalism almost becomes like a fashion, and then you go, you know, you contrast it with the fact that if you're at the bottom of the pile, of course, you will be fined and you will go to prison. Unlike these other guys who will just get away with it.
And a 20% reduction in your wages as well.
Wasn't the whole thing that the Founding Fathers talked about with British corruption is that a certain amount of corruption is baked into any system.
Mm.
It's just what is the tolerable level of corruption versus an absolute shit show. I mean, I always remember the book Why Nations Fail. Anybody ever read that? You know, and they were talking about, well, you know, it's not like Britain and America don't have corruption. Obviously they do, it's low enough, or it's, you know, that the rules are enforced enough that most of the time the system functions well, and that, you know, things actually work. Whereas in a place like Africa, the corruption is so total, you know, it's like the Empire of Dust, you know, you sign a contract and the people don't actually do the job. Or like even in places like Italy, I've heard it can take like 3 or 4 months to do a basic fix on something. Whereas here, okay, it might be more expensive or whatever, but at least the job will actually get done at the end of the day. And that this is the difference. That doesn't mean that there's no corruption in Britain. It just means that it's still less than some of these other examples.
Yeah, and this is the point he was making with the trap, is we tried to devise systems whereby self-interest and venality was kind of brought into the system and made to work by changing the incentives for people and increasingly bureaucratizing modern life. You gave people's, if you like, their egotistical and criminal urges somewhere to go so they could game the targets by being hospital managers or being public service managers and you know, fiddling how they got their figures down rather than fingers in the till. Because they would still get their bonus as a result of, as a reward for complying with that system of management.
A guy in the chat saying Empire of Dust is about tardiness, poor organization, low IQ, not necessarily corruption. Look, there are contracts signed in Empire of Dust and he turns up. Remember when the guys just haven't turned up to do the polls? That is a dereliction of a contract that is signed. If that happened in this country, that company would be sued, or that company would be put to task, or there would be consequences for not following through. So this is like what I'm saying is the difference between corruption being absolutely endemic in a system and they're actually just being a low level of, you know, relatively manageable level of corruption. You know, in Empire of Dust, those same contractors, you know, if you wanted to do an under-the-table deal with them, you could. You try to do an under-the-table deal in Britain most of the time, and the police might show up. You see what I'm saying? Like, there is an actual difference between proper corrupt places and somewhere like here, which is not to say there's no corruption. And I actually think that Donald Trump represents a kind of step into further corruption in America. I think America is currently kind of going through the, you know, a deeper endemic level of corruption than they've been used to since the founding fathers. That's what I would say.
In Britain, I think probably this applies to America and one or two other places, maybe Germany and a few other places as well. But there's like what makes it sort of less clear and less obvious that, you know, corruption goes on and is in some ways kind of normalized or even legal, you know, and thus sort of routine. But like the thing that shrouds that is that there is a very good sort of platform of governance, of corporate governance and other bodies, you know, like a lot. I think that's one thing that England probably, and if, yeah, as I say, a small handful of countries worldwide excel at. And what good governance enables is that you can join an enterprise, doesn't have to be a business enterprise, but, you know, any sort of body, knowing that you're working to a certain charter or a certain set of, you know, principles and stuff, and that everyone's signed up to that and will be held to that. That enables a common understanding to work on, like, rather than, having to wonder whether this or that person is just running it as their own fief, or because they actually can't, you know, in good governance, like, or they're prevented in 10 different ways from doing that, you know, or they're just there to draw out as much money as, obviously that failed in the case of what was it called, you know, the Rover plant, failed in that case and some others, but compared to the rest of the world, England does excel at that.
Look at what happened to Angela Rayner as an example, right? Like you could say, well, okay, she's not in the club, right? You know, if it was a made man, if it was Peter Mandelson or something, you know, she wouldn't have had that. But actually, it did happen to Peter Mandelson, and actually, it did happen to Angela Rayner. The point, and you know, every once in a while, there's a kind of expenses scandal or something, which shows that people are actually held to account once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, the Schmittian exception. Yes, there will be corruption. Yes, there'll be, you know, there will be some people doing under the table deals and so on. But there's enough of that enforcement of the kind of basic norm that the country...
Still a norm. It's still a norm in people's minds. People still expect it. So yeah.
Exactly. Versus in some other places where, you know, oh, well, I'll just pay off the judge. You know, some like proper like tin pot dictatorship in South America or something. Oh, I'll just pay him off. Or, you know, my dad's a gangster, so he'll get me out of it somehow. You know what I mean? It's just like...
I've been to a couple of third world countries where the border guards were openly taking bribes in front of everyone. It was disgusting. It was like shocking, but it was the board, like it was the openly done. Like, oh, it was unbelievable to watch. But it made you value Britain, where that's like much less common. You know, much like there'd be an outcry against it. I mean.
Будут 20% высчитывать и все. Сделала по глупости. Работаю вот сейчас сестрой хозяйкой. Все у меня вещи в руках, все у меня материальная ответственность на 30 тысяч на моей голове. А вот видите, по глупости, что делалось. Что это стакан вина, что это делает.
Is that that famous statue?
Yeah, that's the Mamayev Kurgan Memorial again. Seems to be Volga located in a lot of this footage.
Volga Grace?
Yeah, you sort of can't tell whether they're sort of in grief or drunk or both.
Phobos means what? That's a Greek word, isn't it?
Fear. It's Phobos 2, you know, the moons of Mars are Phobos and Deimos, which mean fear and terror. And this was the probe they sent. It's quite a, it can get to be a bit of a spooky story. It's one of the sort of UFO conspiracist type of favorite subjects, because Curtis will tell, but the probe, we'll see what happened to it. That's the... that's the funicular in Tbilisi, up what's called a Mount Matatsminda. The important shot here is he's just going to come up to it. It's going to be a shot of like a church building, which is what's called the Matatsminda Pantheon. And that's where all the great writers and national heroes, there it is, of Georgia were buried, including Stalin's mum, apparently.
But not Stalin?
No, he's at the Kremlin.
He went to a seminary in Tiflis, in Tbilisi, didn't he? That was his schooling.
That's where he was from, yeah.
Senior school. Well, he was from a smaller village, I think.
Way from Georgia, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, he got educated in a seminary, an Orthodox seminary in Tiflis.
So... Pause. So you see here, this is quite eerie, this footage here, because you know, this is this demonstration, this independence demonstration that takes place on the April 9th, 1989, and within a few minutes of these shots, it ends up in what's called the Tbilisi Massacre. That guy on that picture in the background, he's a Georgian national hero called Kakutsa Cholokashvili, and he was essentially a Georgian military officer. And he was a commander of the anti-Soviet guerrillas. He regarded as a national hero. He had been in the Imperial Russian Army, but then when the Bolsheviks came in, he was somewhat against them. And, you know, he took a sort of band of guerrillas into the mountains to fight against the new Soviet government. And his remains actually at this time were still actually buried in Paris when he was, he died there in 1930. But then eventually they brought him back to go into the Pantheon building I told you about a little earlier. We're going to see that there's a churchman who is addressing the crowd saying, you know, do you want, the Russians are here, this is going to end badly, do you want to retreat to the church? That's the patriarch Ilya II. He was the head of the Georgian Orthodox Church. And he was telling them, you know, the danger is real, something is going to happen here very shortly. And so you'll see what happens next.
Pizza!
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 Classic Crisis in the Kremlin move. That's what I would have done. Suppress.
Did you say 89? This is
April the 9th, 1989. Yeah.
Because there was these demonstrations and an attempt. Oh, let me next pause. I'll talk about it. There was these, I don't know exactly when it was, but in Lithuania especially, and I think Latvia and Estonia, there was these protests that began.
Yeah.
I can't remember if that was in 90 or 90. I don't know.
Yeah, like 89, 90, 91, there was a lot of these independence movements springing up.
And they were trying to break away, at least those Baltic states. They were quite blatantly saying, we should be independent.
Yeah.
And Gorbachev was apparently kind of heavily pressured. He was struggling to keep control of his government. He wasn't that keen to, send tanks in and stuff, obviously. But that did happen, and a few people were killed at the demonstrations and stuff. And I'm guessing this is at the same time. Where it said Gorbachev panicked and sent in troops, I'm guessing because he was under such pressure from his hardliners who were like, you're letting this thing fall apart, you know, we've got to stomp on them. Not that he was necessarily that eager to do it, but... Yeah.
Well, he was trying to still make communism work, essentially. That was...
Yeah, he never envisaged the USSR breaking up into loads of countries.
No. There was about 4,000 people injured, 21 people were killed at this thing.
Wow, I never even heard of this.
Çeyizlepar, Amsaç işrebam ve darça. Suram denimet. Armiton. Çevostulie roşmilepo. Gezlevar, lotsvar kortheva. Romantzan de bakla. That I would have that casualties, Swinder Georgis, Ecclesiashi, the Marlo Bashersi was Rupal.
Ara! 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 Ara!
Ara! Ara! Ara!
Ara! Ara! Ara!
I'm sorry, what did happen there? He said to them to proceed to the church, and they said no. And then he just stood there.
Yeah, and then the Soviet troops came in, and they used a lot of poison gas and a lot of sticks, and killed people.
Do we see that?
There'll be a bit of chaotic footage that comes a little bit after this. It's nothing too graphic or anything like that, but you can see they weren't messing around. This is the Cosmos Hotel again from the other week with the dirty water coming out the taps, and these are just the Russian women who are doing a little bit of prostitution on the side.
My darling.
What are we doing then? Mm-hmm.
It's cold.
Where's the mic?
Maybe it's hidden in her bag or something.
Where's my darling? What is this?
Mm-hmm.
What is this?
This is pacemaker.
Operation?
Operation.
God.
The mouths. Is this to make them sick or kill them or what?
Well, it killed a number of them, so it probably wasn't good.
Chemical warfare.
Yeah.
What? Why?
Pause. Well, this is quite interesting. This is obviously, you know, perestroika, glasnost. Perestroika is the word for the sort of economic restructuring, and glasnost is this idea of openness. This was Gorbachev's, you know, project to sort of, you know, regenerate the Soviet. And part of it was overturning things. Like, there was a ban on bodybuilding in the Soviet Union. They thought it was a manifestation of Western ideology of, you know, curation of the individual. And so this was actually a big thing because the Soviet weightlifters they trained underground. They had these sort of underground gyms called Kachalas. And they were sort of, you know, doing, you know, pumping iron in basements and things, you know, and they would sort of make their own weights out of, you know, bits and pieces from factories. And then in 87, they legalized it. And that meant that these guys could compete. So this was kind of a marker of a sort of cultural change. I mean, it obviously looks extremely odd to us, but it was kind of a big thing because then they could enter things like there was the European Bodybuilding Championships, the IFBB. In 1989. So it was kind of it was just a sign of something from the West, kind of, you know, the radical individualism of, refashioning your own body becomes suddenly acceptable.
Could they not have continued to ban the thing of pinching up your pants between your cheeks?
Like, I wish they had.
Why have they all done that? They're showing off the cheeks in particular. This guy nearest us, look, he's got the physique of like Davy Boy Smith, don't you think? Huge lats, enormous lats.
In my mind, I'm thinking this is very Arnie style. Arnie.
Yeah. That is what he did before.
But also like the pants up the bum. I feel like Arnie did that as well.
If you're going down a water slide, you do that, right?
I think it's like a thong, isn't it?
It's just a pair of sort of like weightlifter undies kind of things. I mean, I did, in doing a bit of research, a few of the pictures of these guys came up, and I must say they're very impressive. I mean, I don't think they had access to steroids. They might have done, but they put in the hours. The Soviet weightlifters, I can say that.
Bodybuilding is impressive. It takes a hell of a lot of work and discipline.
Yeah,
but I can see why it was banned, right? Because when you try to convince people that they only need like 2,000 calories a day to live, or whatever, to work like a 12-hour day, 6 days a week, you do need people to not be eating like 4,000 or 5,000 a day and like that's 10 eggs, you know. Right?
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting question. Yeah, where were the extra calories coming from? It's interesting.
You can't get it.
They always did well at the Olympics, though, the USSR, didn't they? Even like into the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, there's always this suspicion of doping, especially these German athletes, things like that. But I mean, again, you know, you look at a lot of these guys, and I think they were sort of very keen. That's all I could say.
That picture in the background, Marx, Lenin, and Marx, Engels, and Lenin. There's variations of that, aren't there? There's, you know, sometimes it has a start, sometimes it has
disgracefully airbrushed out comrade Stalin.
Yeah, you do see that sort of. There was shots in one of the previous series. You had murals in Moscow on the side of apartments of the three biggies of communism.
See, part of me just thinks, looking at Yeltsin here, this is Trump, this is Javier Milei, this is Farage, this is just like their
Twice.
Man. This is their man. You want to understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what I feel like.
This is David Ball.
The pantomime leader sort of shoved to the front.
Yeah, as we absolutely ransacked the country and, you know, special interests.
I
don't know if Curtis's caption really related it correctly. Like, it said Yeltsin thought that perestroika wasn't working. I don't obviously Yeltsin was personally ambitious, wasn't he? He was like,
yeah,
trying to just become president of Russia. That was his like ambition.
Yeah.
Rather than saving the Soviet Union.
Начальники и все работающие. Как я, например, могу жить? Вот это вот забастовка. До чего
она была? Я согласна, ребята. Infamous gulag place. Oh, yeah.
That's right. Можно мне
сказать? See, I can't help but think that communism hadn't been tried since 1956, basically. Mm. I know that will sound ridiculous, but
yep.
there is a version of reality in which that is true.
What about the Brezhnev years, though?
The thing you've got to remember about Stalin is that he was very much the high, low, middle mechanism. He was a big, strong man, united with the people.
Quite sure.
He set up the middle management, the bureaucracy layer, as the enemy in a way. Whereas Brezhnev was literally that middle management layer in charge.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
So not re-deepening the communist system, just continuing.
I mean, that was always the criticism of the Soviet system, you know, wasn't it? You know, when I was a kid and in the 80s, it was always like these old dead waxwork kind of characters that were just completely lifeless, who were just pushed to the front of the balcony on the May Day parade, and they were sort of interchangeable, and they were very old men, and they all kept dying, and they had no kind of real, you know, they weren't like motivational leaders, let's say, like effective managers, as the woman said last week about Stalin.
I remember, I think it was Charles Pell, Charles Powell, but you know, or Margaret Thatcher, one of the two, talking about when Thatcher first met Gorbachev, and they said, yeah, like she'd met people from, at least, maybe not the men themselves, but from Brezhnev, from Andropov, and from Chernenko. And they said, yeah, like they couldn't really talk normally because, like, you know, it was either the leader themselves or an ambassador or whatever. But they were so rigid because it was almost like they had to keep phoning home to ask what they were allowed to say and reply to every question. They couldn't, but, you know, like they had documents to consult, like what's an acceptable answer to all this. It's like, yeah, they couldn't negotiate normally.
Someone in the chat saying, could you say Starmer is a kind of Brezhnev?
Yeah, I mean, I think that... The Western system is atrophied to the point where, if Blair was Stalin, Starmer is, or if Thatcher was Stalin, or, you know, if they were figures from that kind of era, like the Lenin and the Stalin, Joe Biden was very Brezhnev-y, wasn't he?
Mm.
And this is why people have made the comparison between Trump and Gorbachev before now as well, so yeah.
It's photography.
Yeah. Pause.
Oh, but by the way, by the way, sorry.
Yeah, go
that
on.
UFO stuff from last week that we talked about.
Hmm.
I happened to watch. I was back in Wales on the weekend, and my brother was there, and he put on some of the stuff that has been released by the FBI. And I'm like, there's hours and hours of this stuff. Not a single one of them is caught on like high definition HD. Every single last scrap of it is a grainy dot. Like even now in 2026,
that can't be right. That implies it's bullshit.
So I'm just saying that it's like, you know, everybody's got a phone now, a HD definition phone, And yet all the footage is this grainy security kind of heat cams and all this sort of stuff.
One frame every 2 seconds. I've got a friend who insists on all this stuff, and like, yeah, that's what I've said to him loads of times. Can you just find me one bit of, I mean, I know he can't because I would have heard about it already, but like, just find me one bit of footage, of clear footage of a UFO. Just why not? Like, there's all these hundreds of thousands now of instances of contact. Just fucking film one of them. Like, it's simple. But anyway,
yeah, that
doesn't seem to bother him.
So they sent out a couple of probes on the Phobos mission, and one basically had computer problems and died on the way to Mars. And the Phobos 2 was, as you see here, it was just literally approaching Phobos, this moon of Mars, and it got within about 50 meters, and then it just completely cut out. And there's all sorts of conspiracy stuff built into this if you look into it online. It basically, the technician who was watching told the guys to take some pictures as it was approaching, because they realized they were losing computer power in the remaining vehicle. And it caught these sort of enigmatic pictures of the surface of Phobos. And one of the things that it seemed to show, and which there was much debate about, was it seemed to be there was a strange shadow of something that was behind the vehicle as it was approaching the surface. And it looked like a kind of elliptical shadow, like a sort of cigar-shaped shadow. And people, proposed that this might have been some alien vehicle. But by looking at the sort of, the size of the shadow based on the picture, the vehicle would have been about 15 miles long, something like that. And there was also a picture on the surface of Phobos. I think it was on the surface of Phobos, of what appeared to be a monolith, basically. It's a very strange, anomalous kind of looking. It's speculated to be some sort of rock debris formation. I mean, these moons of Mars essentially were bits of, space debris smashed together, which then began orbiting the planet in the beginning. And this particular monolith was there. I mean, essentially is the kind of, it casts a very strange straight shadow. It's basically the shape and form of a skyscraper, so it looks kind of, it's about it's about 300 foot high. It looks very strange. But the fact that the spaceship cut out, its contact with the mission control at this point has led to all sorts of, speculation about it. The interesting thing, I looked on the wiki entry to start with, and there was an interesting paragraph there about Phobos 2, which I thought I'd read out. It said, Phobos 2 started to develop problems during the interplanetary flight phase of the mission. By the time the probe reached Mars orbit, two of its three computers were malfunctioning. One computer was completely dead, and a second was starting to fail. Since the probe depended on two computers to agree on any decision, the one healthy computer would not be able to control the craft because it could not outvote the two bad computers. I felt there was something about democracy in there. I don't know. It just seemed like a resonant paragraph.
But what's that saying about democracy is two wolves and a sheep?
The healthy computer can't outvote the bad computers.
It's too bad. Bad AI is going after Grok or something.
It just sparked something in me when I read it. I thought it was something about this idea of, I think Curtis is using it as, the Soviet Union was heading on this unknown trajectory towards this thing, and then suddenly it just cuts out, and things just don't work, and you're in darkness, and it's all very spooky. And where does it go from here? Again, it's another metaphor that he's using with the footage, I think. Unknown territory.
Never heard of this instance before. They killed dozens of people.
About 20 people.
Wow.
She doesn't look well.
Never heard a word about this.
Imagine having been killed in 1989 for the Soviet Union.
Mm.
Like literally on the eve of it collapsing. That would be like the worst possible way to go out.
Without seeing Hasselhoff's moment of glory.
The scorpions and, yeah, the wall. I think in a way this is his little kind of montage that he often does towards the end of a series. He has these images of isolated individuals. He has the man in the village who's looking slightly mentally ill. There's the dead woman. There's Gorbachev here, kind of, you know, the loneliness of command, the isolation of power, you know. So there's all these elements of social disconnection, ambition, and being lost in a dream like Yeltsin, a sort of mainly vodka-powered dream.
He looks like he's having a good time. Chill.
Curiously. He's...
Maybe Yeltsin varied it that day and had a Valium instead or something. Is this Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, the Russian adaptation.
I don't remember this happening. When did this happen?
No, I'm not sure which bit of Lord of the Rings this is meant to be. But I think it's something about, you know, putting on the ring of power and forgetting yourself.
This is the bit where he sees the wraiths, essentially. He's put
on the
wraiths.
Yeah, that's what I think it's something to do with, yeah. And this is this idea of, I think, retreating into cultural soporifics, you know, like a bit of American jazz-type culture, you know, or alternatively, political activism. It's, as he shows in the next frame.
Also shades of that movie Downfall. Remember?
Yeah.
When dancing they're dancing. Dancing and, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you like jazz, don't you? I'm quite into jazz.
Are you trying to... You're winding me up.
You having a laugh?
Yeah, I am winding you up. Yeah, I agree. It's awful.
Bloody awful.
Sort of nobody appears to be paying attention.
I do like that Kind of Blue by Miles Davis.
I didn't even give it that. I just don't even give it that. Fuck Miles Davis.
The first track. I don't want to dox anyone, but I was sitting near Radlib the other week chatting to another person we know. I don't know if I'm doxing anyone. They just immediately, like the moment they started talking, they just immediately got into Miles Davis. I was like, what? You two are big. They are. They're both big jazz fans. Yeah.
It's not a crime to like jazz. It's just.
No, I.
No, maybe one doesn't like it.
It's since I learned about the politics of it and the way, you know,
it's a little bit right deviation, isn't it, Simon?
No,
I have a couple of Debris records. I mean, you know, and standard issue stuff back in the 90s when, you know,
there's almost any genre I could find a few tracks.
I like what jazz tracks were. I like Weather Report.
First up,
Birdland, is it? Birdland, Weather Report, Birdland. I like albums by who's that funky organ guy? Back in the Chicken Shack. Who's that guy? Jimmy Smith. Jimmy Smith. Albums by Jimmy Smith. That's jazz, right? Anything by Jimmy Smith. I like Birdland, Weather Report. I like the song that they dance to in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf when they go to that little club. Remember that scene where they have that little dance? Like there's like a jazz tune that Elizabeth Taylor is dancing to when she's trying to wind George up dancing with a young guy. You know, that track. And I like 1920s, 30s. Music by what's his name? Reisman. Reisman and his orchestra. This is a Leon Reisman and his orchestra. That style of early jazz, I don't mind too much.
Very discriminating choices, I must say. Deep consideration there.
Yeah, deep hits. Most of the rest of it is wank. I don't mind Cole Porter, if that counts as jazz. I don't know if it counts as jazz. Some of that sort of stuff. Although I prefer him himself rather than, you know, Ella Fitzgerald. I think Ella Fitzgerald is wildly overrated, personally. No soul. You know,
who's the one anyway. Who did Summertime with Louis Armstrong? Is that Ella Fitzgerald?
Yeah, she did a lot of stuff with Louis Armstrong. She was always around. You know, one of the best bits of Ebola is when he literally just describes Ella Fitzgerald as a shambling mound of flesh. He is very scathing about Ella Fitzgerald, I kind of agree with him.
Yeah. Well, what is that song "Minnie the Moocher" by Cab Calloway? Is that jazz? Does that count as jazz?
I think it probably does. Yeah, I think it probably does.
In the Blues Brothers, isn't it? You know, when he's old Cab Calloway sings it.
So really, it's just I guess what you know, modal, freeform, wank jazz is what I don't like.
Yeah.
I have tolerance for 20s, you know, like the kind of music from The Shining. You know, when it sounds a bit like that, I kind of don't mind that era of jazz, and Al Boley and Al people Boley, like this, yeah. And
it's all forgotten now.
Piano sort of stuff.
Yeah, I don't mind. I mean, all of the stuff from the Great American Songbook, I don't mind that so much. Or what I'm really against is like Miles Davis.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, like the really crazy stuff. Do you know that guy Gilad Atzmon? I did a few interviews with him on my YouTube channel.
Mm.
Like he, obviously, he's known as like a philosopher and like pro-Palestine sort of guy. But he, one of the reasons he moved to London when he moved out of Israel was. Specifically the bebop and what is it, you know, what's the other kind of jazz, like bebop and I'd say rocksteady, the other types of jazz, like it was, yeah, he's like a fabulous, like fluent saxophonist. It was amazing player. Crazy stuff.
Yeah
he was one of the blockheads. Yeah that's the crazy stuff you're talking about though, that right, that's that freeform sort of improvised stuff that you're talking about. It's not really songs, it's playing. It's just like,
I just think it's a kind of form of masturbation in public.
Yeah. The playing can be outstandingly skillful, obviously. We're not saying that. But yeah, like,
nobody, well, like right, if the person is enjoying it more themselves than anybody watching, that's the issue.
Yeah. Right. The same happened with prog rock and guitar.
Yeah, I'm not a prog fan either for this extreme. Like if there's a 20-minute guitar solo, that is wanking on record.
Yeah.
Just no room for it whatsoever. It can be nicely bounded by the, you know, outer structures of the song, right? You can get away with it, but if you can't wrap it up in a minute or so, you're overstaying your welcome. In my view.
Music must be played according to Carlyle's gospel of work. You know, it must be slightly unpleasant, but improving.
Didn't he call music the dismal science? No, I'm mixing.
Yeah. No, I'm not against music. Yeah. I'm not against music. I'm just against on-stage masturbation or on-record masturbation.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. But Rick Wakeman was infamous for that in rock, you know, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer were infamous when they, you know, for like self-indulgent bullshit. And it's true. You listen to their albums, they're just not very good.
Yeah.
But the use of jazz that I shrink from is just when I think of people like kind of glorying and exulting in how subversive it was, basically, or how
it's kind of the Far Show parody of jazz, isn't it? You know, the sort of
yeah.
I was thinking earlier,
gapingly like, pretentious.
That's a funny parody that I liked. Yes. Yeah, that jazz club guy. But I'm talking, I guess, like 30s, 40s or something. When AA did a video about it, right, where it was like.
Yeah.
Did you do a video about this a few years ago where it's like specifically inserted into radio, TV, clubs and so on, you know, and that is sinister and gross. Like obviously some of the music can be all right.
You're allowed to like bits of jazz. It's not a sign of spiritual jazzification.
Somebody pointing out that I like rap. I will point out that where rap goes jazzier, I'm down on it. Because that such as
Jazzy Jeff.
Common.
Jazzy Jeff was just a hip-hop guy. He didn't do it. He didn't actually go jazzy.
Common sense. Or when... It's always when they get a bit more soulful and it's like, they're finding themselves.
Mm,
now jazz, more jazz influence has to come in and they've kind of turned to love.
Music is therapy.
Which means they're not shooting each other up and gangbanging, which is what the heart of rap should be about. You know, they've ascended. You know, they've ascended to kind of more spiritual matters, rather than the raw form of rap, which is men aggressively saying how they're going to kill each other.
Hmm. Whereas you want the manly side.
Well, I think the elements of rap should be there's a braggadocio element, whether it takes the form of I'm better at rapping than you, or I'm simply better than you, so therefore I'll kill you, or I'm better than you because I shag more women. You know, it is not a form that lends itself to high art. Much like pro wrestling in this respect, it does not pretend high art. It's not a high culture form. It's a low culture form, and therefore it must embody itself. And when it has pretensions to more, it tends to not to go well. I would say that is also true of pro wrestling. The heart of pro wrestling is two men battle it out for who is better. If you try to make it high concept, it becomes wanky. The kind of wrestling version of jazz was when Shawn Michaels said, I love you, before giving the super kick to Ric Flair. Now, I absolutely love Ric Flair, okay? But that was self-indulgent wank. It was self-indulgent. That was the equivalent of doing the noodling solo in the middle of a wrestling match, and it was wank. Sorry, Shawn Michaels fans, but that was wank. All right, let's carry on. People mentioning beef art. Beef art is the opposite of freeform. There's nothing freeform in beef art at all. To the point where he famously punished people for going outside of their place. He was basically a dictator. So in fact, there's a good example of a solo in the song "Bug Eyed Beans from Venus." Is that what it's called? "Bug Eyed Beans from Venus." Is that the song? But in that song by beef art, there's a very good example of the Mr. Zolo, or whatever his name is, playing the long lunar note, and it is bounded by the structure of the song. It doesn't just go off on one. It's not just wankery. There's a purpose to it. So, yeah, I've got a lot of time for beef art. Because beef art, if you understand what's happening, is not your freeform jazz wank.
I had a friend back when I was about 17, a friend I had in college who I guess probably read all the music magazines and stuff and had sort of learned. He obviously had a lot of inherited ideas about music, but he thrust Trout Mask Replica in my hand one day and insisted it's the best album ever. I listened to it, not really my bag, but it was very, very tightly played. Like, I mean, absolutely precision playing, absolutely as tight as anything I've ever read. It reminds me a little bit of King Crimson. Have you heard King Crimson's first album? But yeah, they are jazz musicians, I think. At least the drummer was already a jazz.
Oh, we love our Crimson. Bandits.
Yeah, like In the Court of the Crimson King, obviously, is
quite brilliant. Well,
what's the other? Yeah, there's other tracks. The playing is exquisitely precise.
What I'd say with beef art is that is a lot of people's experience with beef art is that they are thrust Trout Mask Replica. Yeah. It is actually told it's brilliant. The trouble is that it's his least accessible album. I would start with Clear Spot or Safe as Milk or Dock at the Radar Station or Shiny Beast or something. I would not start with Trout Mask if you're trying to get into beef art, because at their heart, it's a blues band, not a kind of wank jazz band. So once you understand that the meat and bones of it is blues, you can kind of, I feel like Beef Art is a little bit missold. But I would start with an album called Clear Spot. That would be the one. If you never listen to Beefheart, start with that, and then you can start to range, because it's kind of, you know, coming from normal music, it's more accessible. But anyway, let's go.
So, yeah, but you're saying don't just force people to listen to Bitches Brew. Put on Kind of Blue. Yeah, let's move on. Let's go.
Yeah, I would leave Tramp Mask Replica for last, if any of them, you know.
Right.
Anyway.
This was in hypernormalization.
Yeah. Pause. Yeah, just briefly, that's another excerpt from a short film called Zinky Boys Go Underground by Paul Tickell, which he did reference in Hypernormalization. The maker of the film, Paul Tickell, actually put an article online. He said, why is Adam Curtis using my footage? Is he trying to portray it as reality, or is he, you know, just using it as a dramatic piece? Because he obviously doesn't cite the piece, but I mean, that's Curtis. He kind of elides bits of real footage and bits of dramatic footage, and, you know, it's all about creating a mood. Zinky Boys is a reference to the soldiers who went to Afghanistan. When the bodies were sent back, they were often sent back in these zinc coffins, which would be sort of delivered at, you know, 2 a.m. and just left outside people's apartments for their relatives. And it's about these guys who sort of form a little crime gang on the underground in Moscow. You know, I think Curtis is talking about, you know, people kind of, you know, as they're chased out of Afghanistan, you know, and they come back and communism has collapsed, people are kind of going mad with this sort of new market shock therapy and social decay. And this little girl who's going to come up, she's going to recur, a little girl called Natasha. This is from a documentary called Russian Wonderland by a guy called Colin Luke. This was done in 1995. And basically he just went around Russia and he gave people video cameras to play with. And so he gave them to families and individuals to just sort of film their lives. And this little girl is being filmed. I don't know if it's by her mother or whatever, but she's a sort of beggar on the streets of Moscow, and she's unusually precocious. And she gives this little speech about what's going on in Russia at this time, which we'll see in a minute.
Just before I forget, by the way, on Beefheart, sorry to go back to that, but I was going to do a Deepest Lore back in the old format of Deepest Lore on Beefheart. And when I started reading up on him, I was like, I'm not actually sure if I want to do this, because he was an exceptionally dark character, engaging in what can only be described as human slavery and barely afford to eat. And he was kind of keeping them on a strict diet of beans and things like this. Very strange, controlling individual. But anyway... let us go back to this. Speaking of which, this is a very disturbing image we pause on here.
Yeah, indeed.
И у нас здесь все недорого. Вовтом и в розницу продаются сам пистолет японский, дранский. Потому что они будут сонрайны. Покупайте что-нибудь и гудбай, сэри лайт.
Pause a second. Seems that our, we got Madman 96 in the chat says, awesome impromptu music discussion, DL undefeated. Like, people are actually really enjoying this like, little interlude into music, which is cool. Loads of people love King Crimson,
yeah,
seems in the chat. And you do as well, Simon, right?
I do like, well, especially that first album. I'm not a huge expert on King Crimson. I listen to bits and pieces now, but the first album, I played it on heavy rotation for a long time when I heard it. I mean, it was only a couple of years ago, and I thought, why have I never listened to this before? It's an essential album. In the Call of the Crimson King. It's just fantastic.
I listened to that one a lot as well. That was one of the ones because, you know, I was like everyone else, just controlled by the magazines, essentially. Like, you've got to listen to this one, you know. Much like Trout Mask, that was the other one that everybody had to listen to. So
I did see someone in the chat saying the Residents were a jazz band. They were avant-garde.
they were an avant-garde meta-pop group, essentially, a meta-rock group.
It's a funny not idea.
Jazz.
There's another one.
Jazz. They couldn't even bloody play instruments. After their career.
The,
The Court of the Crimson King, I never heard of King Crimson. They're not like as famous, anywhere near as famous as some of the prog groups, right? But one of my friends got me into Tool, you know, the metal band, like the sort of innovative metal band, like Tool. They're unusual, like they're sort of heavy, but they actually really can write good songs and stuff. And they're unusual as well. But their producer had previously produced King Crimson. That was the link.
I think they sort of stand alone in Prague. They're kind of a very serious musicians band, very detailed.
They must have, yeah, and they are brilliant musicians. It's Robert Fripp, right? He only gets in the best guys. Yeah. And people who obviously like try and understand what he's doing with his songs and stuff. But the, I can't remember what I was going to say about that. Oh, yeah. I don't think they put singles out, and you don't hear of them touring much or big places anyway. But they were once on Radio 2. For some reason, I was listening to Jonathan Ross on a Saturday afternoon. He played the whole of the track in the Court of the Crimson King for like 15 minutes or something. And that was unusual. But it's a brilliant album.
In my mind, King Crimson are like the main prog rock band. Who were the bigger ones?
They are.
Well, if you count them as... Or they could say they're blues.
Well, Pink Floyd is prog rock, you're saying? I'm not sure.
I mean, if you had to categorize,
it's more psychedelic.
I wouldn't have thought. I mean, my mind goes to. I like the band called Renaissance. You hear them?
No.
They were around in that kind of in that same period, but they're much more kind of loving in a way, like hippie-ish. Yeah. Trying to think, like Yes, are they?
And people saying Genesis and Caravan and the kind of the Cambridge scene, is it?
Yeah, that's probably
ELP,
Emerson, Lake and Palmer, sort of Rick Wakeman's. Yes, had a constantly changing.
I think it just feels King Crimson kind of stands sort of on its own in amongst that because they're just
King Crimson dabbled in like heavy metal riffs as well in the 70s. They were way ahead of.
Does Steely Dan count as a prog rock group, or is that?
No, I think there was sort of more of like a jazz influence.
There is actually then veering into jazz rock or something like that. Is it?
Yeah, Gentle Giant, my friend Hector Drummond's favorite band. Yeah, Canterbury Scene. Sorry, not Cambridge Scene. What am I thinking? I'm thinking of Pink Floyd being based around Cambridge. Yeah, Canterbury Scene. Beg your pardon. Right. Old man, memory.
But I noticed amid all the prog chat and Captain Beefheart references, Harry Flashman in the chat put Joey Beltram, Energy Flash. Do you guys know that track?
No,
there's nothing to do with jazz or pop.
I feel like a Beltram. I don't know if it was that track, but a Beltram track made it to the 90s bangers better than Madonna that I put out.
Energy Flash, I think, is one of the very top few dance tracks ever made. It's absolute fucking storming track. I just recommend everyone put that on after the stream. I want to see what people think. It's like almost evil sounding, but in a good way. Like, I don't like harsh dance music or anything. It's like menacingly clubbish somehow, menacingly ravey, but in a good way. Like, it's good.
Someone in the chat saying, I bet I'm older than you, effers, and I never listened to Pink Floyd. That's because you're not a radical individual like me.
You're an individual. I should say that you mentioned Rick Wakeman.
Mm.
I recently put on in the car Sixth Wise of Henry VIII, and AAA really got into the track Anne of Cleves.
Oh.
And in fact, this was when we went to Hever Castle, because I was like, we're going to Hever Castle, so I'll put on the Sixth Wise of Henry VIII. The missus was very scoffing. She was like, this has nothing to do with Henry VIII. He just had a bunch of music and he didn't think about it at all. But anyway, she really got into Anne of Cleves and basically for a period of about a week wanted it on repeat over and over and over again, which is a little bit unusual, but yeah, she very much got into the track Anne of Cleves. So I thought I'd mention that. You know? Anyway, there's minutes left, guys. There's minutes left.
This is the outplay sequence, actually. So yeah, just let it...
Sounds are amazing. Is that music?
This is Lawrence English's soundtrack that he did. It's a very spare, sort of industrial-sounding soundtrack, but it's Curtis's idea that, you know, the collapse of belief in everything, you know, everything is kind of cratering and going underground. And this is why this episode featured all these kind of dissident, nonconformist artists and, you know, cultural works that are sort of trying to remain hidden out of sight of the regime, but are maybe pointing at the rot within. Curtis, in one of the interviews, said that Russians have said to me, Britain is just Moscow in 1988. I do have a sense that this also feels like a place in the very final days of empire, the same strange nostalgia, the same dark pessimism about democracy, and that feeling the ground is now starting to move quite rapidly under our feet.
Beautiful, yes. Mm. Just thinking now, Jethro Tull, are they prog then?
Oh yeah,
because I like them.
They're good, Aqualung.
With his little fleet, you know, that's a very cool. I mean, they've got a couple of really good albums. They have.
Yeah.
Thick as a Brick.
White and Tree, I think, are another prog group that people cite. Yeah.
In.
They're kind of late 60s bands, really. And going into the early 70s, like they're kind of coming out of that.
Seems like Crimson King was that, I think it's about 68 or something, 69. Sort of a brief kind of flourishing period, it seems. But there are those who know much more than me.
Uriah Heep, I feel like they were around. Did they become, some of them went in a metal direction.
That's right, yeah.
Some of them went in a kind of folk direction.
Right, exactly. People are at metal festivals, I know that, sort of heavy metal scene. Mm. They may have
more some of it goes off into metal, some of it goes into like Steely Dan style jazz stuff, some of it goes into like Genesis, I guess, basically.
What about Marillion? Do
you know that's Marillion? Heavy metal.
You'd call that heavy metal? Nah, that's not heavy. That's no, they're not.
Well,
it's just heavy rock then, okay.
Something. It's not.
Some people call them prog rock.
It's not right.
They're 80s, 90s. Marillion is the most uncool band in the world, I think, but I like them.
So I do have some breaking news, which is that they're saying that Reform are going to be running a new up-and-coming MP. this is actually a left meme. The left have not taken kindly to Blair's intervention. That's interesting. Chris Brimer says, will you sell out the channel and go full shill for Tony if he was appointed to sort out the country? I'd support him. I would personally support him if he was Lord Protector. And I've said that many times. Jamie Smith says, James O'Brien was having a full-on breakdown on LBC this morning over Blair. Oh, my goodness, I've missed that. Maybe I'll have to catch up with it next week. The Vo says nicotine absorbed through the lining of the mouth, gums, and tongue, etc. The Vo is not letting this go. Listen, mate, it doesn't matter because look, when was the last time I had a cigar? I had a cigar on Saturday with my brother, a little H-Upman, 20-minute job. I haven't had a cigar since, and I could go the next week, the next week, the next week, the next month, the next year without having another one, and it wouldn't matter. So you can tell me about nicotine as much as you want. The fact is, it's not addictive. It's not a habit like a cigarette or like being addicted to porn or being addicted to drugs or being addicted to whatever else. I would say I'm more addicted to fucking Coke Zero than I am to cigars. It's not an addictive thing. Now, that's not to say people can't get addicted to it. But what are they getting addicted to? They're getting addicted to, I don't know, maybe the feeling of pulling something up to their mouth or having the thing in their mouth or the routine of it or something like that. But the fact is, you just don't need it. And I smoke a decent amount of cigars too. But, I mean, to prove it's a point, what's the date now? It's the 27th now. It's the 23rd was the Saturday. Let's just say I'll go for the entire week. So that will be, 10 days by next Wednesday, that's the 3rd, on this show, I'll say, like, well, it's been 10 days now. Do I have an overwhelming craving for a cigar? No. Because it's not addictive in that way. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. RG counts as a new member. Thank you very much, sir, for joining. Chris Primer says, I heard some teachers were paid in flower pots during the collapse. Flower pots?
What, the Soviet collapse?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's what
it was. There was the idea that people in the factories were using the wares that the factories would give them in lieu of money and trying to sell them on the street to raise funds, if possible.
And Cheesy Soap says Nick Cage and the Bad Seeds are good. Nick Cave. I'd love to see Nick Cage in the Gad. Can you imagine Nick? That would be a hinge because Nick Cage is crazy, isn't he? That'd be just amazing. But I wouldn't call Nick Cave prog. I call him Southern Gothic Rock. Is that basically a gothic, alternative gothic or something like that?
Yeah,
that's basically his niche, but he has some tremendous albums.
Is he Australian?
Yes.
I think he is.
Yes.
I think he is, yeah. But
and he did a track with Kylie Minogue once in the 90s.
I would go as far as to say there are no bad Nick Cave albums.
He has a credibility that extends over time, yeah.
Quantify that, but pretty, I mean, he's from the start, I would say, looking at his catalog right now, I haven't really listened past Dig Lazarus Dig. That was the last one I paid any attention to. But up until Dig Lazarus Dig, I can't speak to the last four. I'd say there are no weak albums at all from Here to Eternity in 84 to Dig Lazarus Dig in 08. That's a pretty good run, you know, like 10 albums in there. And some of the lesser known ones like Henry's Dream and so on are pretty good, you know. Where can people find you, Simon?
On Twitter at Simon_Roberts. Thanks for tuning in again today.
And Horace
At Infinite Horace on Twitter, where you can see my Substack link as well.
I'd agree that Nocturama was not that good. I would agree with the person who said that. Pick up a course, 25% off all courses, promo code COOL. I may well put that webinar up over the weekend or something if I get a chance. Also, if you've been waiting for a gaming video, the hot weather, and I might put up a post about this in a minute, the hot weather has made it very difficult for me to don the red and the shades because it's quite hot, that outfit, and it's been intolerably hot. So I've been, there's been a, the hot weather is unfortunately got in the way of making more AA gaming videos. So there's just a little pause on those until the heat wave passes. Maybe next week we'll be back up and running, but it's just been too hot to don the red. Sorry about that, guys. Bye, everyone. Go on, Horace. What was that?
Well, I was gonna a question about gaming. I'll ask you offline, don't worry. Thank you.
All right, bye, John. Bye.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here.
Well, that's easily fixed.